Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the Macro Insights podcast with the internet's favorite green chicken, recurring guest, Doomberg. We're going to dive into everything surrounding the energy markets. But before, you had a recent article about the price of oil and OPEC potentially just disbanding. Will it be the end of OPEC? Would this send an absolute shock or tear through the energy markets? Or is this something that is essentially necessary to keep things moving forward?
Yeah, first of all, it's great to be back with you. Always enjoy our appearances on your show. You know, we wrote that piece a couple of months ago, and it was called How OPEC Ends. People don't realize that, like, oil is a very heavily managed market. I mean, I suppose they realize it because OPEC exists, and they have, you know, 35, 40% of the global oil supply, is depending on if you count, you know, OPEC plus. Their job is to keep the price of oil artificially high. And they're slowly but surely failing in that task. All cartels eventually bust, and OPEC will be no different. And it should be said, of course, that OPEC is one of the most successful cartels of all time. They've been at this for several decades. Our main thesis is because of a phenomenon that is occurring mostly in the United States, which is namely the shale revolution and the co-production of oil and natural gas in places like the Permian, the elevated price of oil is causing natural gas to be dirt cheap, so cheap that people are beginning to either switch the engines or manipulate the molecules to displace demand for oil with much cheaper natural gas. And over time, the longer OPEC keeps the price of oil artificially elevated, thereby keeping natural gas production much higher than it would normally otherwise be, that sort of generational arbitrage looks set to chip away at the unique aspects of oil, ultimately changing the very definition of the stuff. And that ultimately will be the undoing of OPEC.
Well, is this something that, you know, I guess like AI could potentially fix? I know you've written a couple articles now recently as well about like the AI's impact on the oil markets. It seems like OPEC is essentially keeping the prices elevated. Would AI be something that could be, you know, able to bring that price back down? Or is it something that would just continue to elevate it as well?
So the impact of AI in the energy markets is an interesting one. In fact, we have a piece coming out tomorrow after we record this podcast, our third in a series on trying to model the first, second, and third order impacts of the AI revolution and the need to power data servers and high-end computers and things like that. One thing that AI could do is it could soak up some of the incremental supply of natural gas, which would be, I suppose, bullish for OPEC's prospects because it would close the arbitrage gap in a way that doesn't materially impact the oil markets. One of the ways in which natural gas is impacting the oil markets, for example, is in China, where people are switching out long-haul trucks with natural gas-powered vehicles and cutting into the demand for diesel. If AI soaks up natural gas in a way that doesn't interfere with the oil markets, that would be on balance positive for OPEC. But there are other things occurring too in AI. For example, AI is being used to rapidly increase the efficacy of exploration and development of oil and gas resources. The oil and gas companies are amongst the most technologically savvy in the world. People always underestimate what they're capable of doing. They're one of the great bastions of increased productivity in the US. And people just assume these are stodgy old commodity companies with not much interesting going on inside of them. So those two forces, you know, more supply, but also AI, natural gas powering AI data servers directly, sort of offset each other. But then I think there's a big third thing that has occurred since we wrote that piece, which is the election of Donald Trump and his subsequent appointment of Chris Wright to be the Secretary of Energy, at least his nomination to that position. We'll see if he gets through the Senate. We suspect he will. Drill, baby, drill is not very good for OPEC. And in fact, I believe on the Joe Rogan show, Trump said something that makes us wonder whether he isn't a Doomberg reader. He mentioned how the way to win the war with Russia is to get the price of oil below Russia's break-even price, which is something we have been arguing since the beginning, which he quoted on the show as being somewhere around $42 a barrel. All of those factors combine, I think, to be pretty bearish for oil, World War III notwithstanding, which we seem to be inching ever closer to with each passing day. But assuming we don't have a nuclear war on our hands in the next 6 to 9 months, the fundamentals for oil point downward.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Trump's the drill baby drill is going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. But you mentioned World War III, and I think yesterday, I want to say we're recording this on the 19th, Ukraine was, you know, launched its first missiles back at Russia, and it was fully funded by the U.S. So, with the end of the Biden campaign coming here, do you think there's still a possibility, or do you think Trump's going to be able to, I guess, like come in and essentially sever this conflict and, you know, avoid that? Or do you think there's still, you know, a decent chance that this, you know, World War III could break out, thus, you know, causing mass chaos?
You know, we are at a truly dangerous time. And if we just pull back and objectively look at the situation, we have a president who was deemed too senile to run, but still fit to serve, which is a great mystery to us, at least. Like, I don't know how you can be mentally incapable of running for president, but still mentally fine to serve as president. The switch, you know, the coup that happened where Harris took over the nomination for the Democrats, ultimately didn't work, and Trump won a relatively resounding victory, swept all of the swing states, and even managed to win the popular vote. And so here we are in a transition period, and Trump's team has signaled they would like the war to end. They would like to de-escalate. Biden and, in particular, his State Department seem to be keen on escalating the war. And the Pentagon seems to have been fighting that impulse for several weeks now. But then suddenly we learn that after months of saying no to the Ukrainians, Biden has decided to allow them to use American missiles to be launched deep into Russian territory. Why is this such a red line, and truly probably the first of Putin's red lines that Biden has actually crossed? Putin and his team argue that those missiles cannot be fired by Ukrainians, and they certainly can't be guided by Ukrainian satellites because Ukraine doesn't have satellites. And so in the eyes of Russia, this is an attack by Americans in the name of America in Russian territory using destructive missiles. Last I checked, if we were going to provoke a war with a nuclear superpower, we should at least have a conversation about it in Congress. So we're in this period of time where nobody knows who's really in charge of the United States. Like, you could visually see the rapid decline of Joe Biden, so we could probably cross him off the list. Harris seems to have disappeared in the aftermath of the election. So who's actually in charge of the U.S. government? Who's authorizing what amounts to a provocation, in the eyes of Russia, at least? Now, there are other things that happened this week that aren't being reported in the West. For example, earlier, Russia launched a wave, you know, well over 100 missiles and drones attacking Ukrainian electricity infrastructure, just as they're heading into the winter heating season. There had been some hope, some discussion, some talk that the two sides might find a bit of a truce on attacking each other's energy infrastructure. Clearly, those talks, if they occurred, did not lead to a successful outcome. You could view the authorization to use American missiles deep inside Russia as a retaliation for what I happen to think are war crimes. Putin's, you know, wanted destruction of largely civilian infrastructure probably qualifies for a war crime under the UN Charter. There's also this mysterious cutting of an internet cable in the waters off Europe, which allegedly has been done by a Chinese vessel. And this morning on Twitter, and you never know what's true on Twitter, I see there are three Danish Navy ships sailing their way towards this Chinese vessel. Who knows what will happen there? I'll close by saying, if you read the propaganda in Russia and China and Ukraine and Iran, Israel, the rest of the world is already in World War III. We're not framing it that way here in the U.S. It certainly wasn't framed that way during the election campaign. And so I think when we look back at this time, it's going to be one of those moments in history where the world will have come far closer to nuclear war than is being described in contemporary media. And let's hope that everyone is amazed that it didn't happen.
Now, when you're describing this as, you know, we're already potentially in World War III, do you see it as more of like a Cold War in a sense where, you know, I've always kind of looked at it where that Russia and, you know, the BRICS nations almost have this energy arm. And because the U.S. just strangleholded themselves essentially and put themselves in this position with the green energy policies, the BRICS nations have been able to pull the energy arm. While on the other side of things, because, you know, we're still in the dollar standard, essentially, the U.S. has been able to pull the monetary arm by, you know, rapidly increasing interest rates and devaluing everybody else's, you know, fiat currency against the dollar. And those are the kind of the two arms that are playing here. Well, now with the drill, baby, drill and President Trump coming in, that would essentially, you know, move away from the power that be in, you know, the Russia and the other BRICS nations. Now, do you see it similarly, or is it more a deeper power struggle than that?
So to clarify what I meant in my previous answer, if you read Russia and Chinese propaganda, what they're telling their citizens, they are already in a kinetic war with NATO and the United States. They're in World War III. And on Russian television over the weekend, there was commentary about which of the European capitals would be the first to get nuked. Like, this is the conversations that are going on inside these societies that we are basically shielded from. If you only read the traditional Western news outlets like The Economist or The New York Times or The Washington Post and so on, you have to sneak around into the darker corners of the internet to find out what other countries are telling themselves about the current situation. In our view, Trump does not want a war. Trump wants to focus internally. Isolationist is probably too strong of a term. He does have some desire to get entangled with Iran, for example. But I think that Trump is more likely to accept a sort of multipolar world where China and Russia and the US compete in an economic sense, but not in a military sense. And Trump's ambitions are to drill, baby, drill, to make the US once again the world's dominant energy power, and to leverage an abundance of cheap energy to catalyze a resurgence of U.S. manufacturing, onshoring of military supply chains, which we think the Pentagon and the military actually wants. And the attempts of the outgoing regime to provoke escalation in Ukraine could be viewed as a specific attempt to derail Trump before he gets into office.
Now, with that, I'm kind of the opinion, almost like tinfoil hatty, but you know, because the other economic powers around the globe do not necessarily like Trump and the way he approaches things, we might see somewhat of a financial collapse just immediately as he gets into office, because he's not necessarily going to, quote unquote, play nice with other countries around the world. And we might see some pain here initially, especially within the first few months of Trump's presidency. Do you subscribe to that theory as well? Or do you think, you know, Trump's going to be able to, I guess, like, you know, some of the policies are not going to hinder maybe as, you know, drastic as I'm maybe lining out here?
No, we've had similar hunches. You know, the question is to whether they, whoever they might be, are going to drop the bags on Trump when he gets to office, and they'll take advantage of his temporary ascendancy to execute the Great Reset that is so badly needed. You know, in the Western world, our debt and economic situations seem, at least on paper, to be you know, not something that can go on forever. And who better to drop the bags on, to kitchen sink the quarter, as we might say in the corporate world, than the orange man himself? That ascribes a little too much power to they in our eyes, and also, I think, underestimates the increase in sophistication that Trump may have acquired during his 4 years plotting his return. He's had plenty of time to ponder what went wrong in 2016 and how that crippled him out of the gate. And early signs are that he seems intent on internalizing those lessons and executing things in a different way. Now, some people would view that as terrible, and some people would view that as great. We were just trying to agnostically analyze the situation. Judging by his picks for his cabinet, he does not seem to be following the similar path of having his administration filled with people that may not be aligned to his core interests. And so if you're on the other side of the aisle, you view his nominees as extremists and, you know, outside of government and out of bounds for what's typical, but he specifically ran on not doing things in a typical fashion. And so it's going to be a fascinating few weeks to watch for sure. By the way, like it's not president yet. Like January 20th is a long ways away. And as we've seen just in the past few days, we're launching American missiles into a nuclear superpower's domestic territory. A lot can change between now and January 20th. It's not even 100% sure that he will actually be president, if you ask us.
What do you mean by that? Why do you think it's...
Until he's sworn in, I mean, they already had two attempts on his life. But, you know, we're a quarter inch away from a wildly different outcome. You know, a quarter inch in Butler, and we're having a completely different discussion today. And so, until he's sworn in, he's not president. And so time will tell.
That is a fair point. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting to see the way that things have been playing out. But I want to get back into AI and the data centers aspect of things. You know, obviously, President Trump, too, you know, made some waves by showing up to the Bitcoin conference. And, you know, Bitcoin mining goes in similarly with AI data centers. Do you see that as a potential revolution as well, to kind of integrate Bitcoin mining as well into data centers as more of the drill baby drill aspect, whether it's capturing flare gas in that aspect, or, you know, are you still a little bit more on the bearish side when it comes to Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, we have no position on or in Bitcoin. We certainly observe it with great entertainment value. I've been watching with keen interest what Michael Saylor is up to at MicroStrategy, and you got to tip your hat to the man. He called his shot, and seems to be working out well for him and for the price of Bitcoin, which is, of course, the two are very much intertwined. Bitcoin mining is, we believe, useful if we continue down the road of forcing intermittent renewables onto the grid, because they allow peaker plants to make money during the off times, and that's really the only way that you could run peaker natural gas plants in a way that's economically useful to those who own them, which would solve part of the intermittency problem for renewables. As it pertains to AI, in the piece we're publishing tomorrow, we make the case that AI and the existing grid are basically incompatible. And in our vision of the future, operators of data centers will become self-contained power producers. They'll vertically integrate in one structure, where you basically have natural gas going in and data coming out. Disconnected from the grid, no need to worry about grid connection backlogs, transmission issues, or even federal oversight in most cases, because as long as it doesn't cross state lines, you can regulate this at the state level. So places like the Permian in Texas, or also, frankly, British Columbia, Canada, where, because it's colder up there, the cooling needs of data centers would be a little easier to address. But wherever you have dirt cheap natural gas, just tacking on incremental electricity demand to the existing grid doesn't win for anybody. It causes prices to go up for all ratepayers. The grid is not designed for that. And electricity is worth way more to AI operators than it is, than what consumers are conditioned to be willing to pay for it. And so we think that we're going to see a divorce between AI and the grids. I think FERC's cancellation of Amazon's nuclear deal in Pennsylvania was an early sign of what's to come. And so in the piece that we're publishing tomorrow, we do sort of a bit of a lateral think about how this might all shake out. And then once you have that as an assumption, then there's all manner of second and third order effects that we dig into.
Yeah. So what are the, I guess, like some of the second and third order effects then? Do you think, you know, that more efficiency, you know, just like lowering the price of oil, would the use of AI just essentially help get down to that, you know, $40 a barrel aspect, or 44, that would essentially help break that Russia break even point?
Well, I think specific to data centers and moving off grid, the second order effect that immediately comes to mind is there's going to be a shortage of gas turbines, and there's only so many companies who make those. They're relatively sophisticated pieces of equipment. And in fact, the next consequence of that is that operators of our existing grid are going to be squeezed on costs, because all manner of demand for power management equipment and so on will crowd out the existing utilities. And instead of being bullish for the utilities, they'll get squeezed on costs without the incremental revenue uplift that Wall Street is currently betting on. So it's admittedly a contrarian call. But in our view, if there's going to be a rush on new electricity production off grid, that can only hurt the grid operators of today. And then the third order impact that we see is, you know, the companies involved here, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, NVIDIA, they're pretty sophisticated. A lot of smart engineers, a lot of talented people. Who knows what innovations await when companies like this decide to get into the power production business. It's not clear to us that the way in which the best way to do this is to stitch together the ways we currently do it, like burn natural gas, you know, spin a turbine, plug in a computer and cool it. To go from natural gas to data, I think we could see an entire rewrite of how that's done. And that sort of Criswellian exponential technological growth, this just might be the next level of that. Now, that's admittedly speculative, but that's what we try to do here once in a while is speculate and get ahead of trends. So that's sort of the last potential outcome that we see and that we write about in the piece.
All right. Well, yeah, that makes some sense. And that could seem to drastically change like the energy markets. But, you know, I guess on the flip side of things, wouldn't that just be obviously, you know, pretty beneficial for the United States just in general? If you look historically, sure. You know.
Yeah, look, we're an energy superpower today. We are an AI superpower today. We have way more data centers than everybody else. We are currently leading the technological race. And you mix in, you know, dirt cheap energy that Trump intends to enable and a manufacturing renaissance. If you're building new plants, just as AI is exploding, we could see this wave of productivity enhancements, which actually, you know, could be the way in which we get ourselves out of the debt spiral. The only two real ways to get out of it is to inflate it away or to have a productivity miracle. And plugging cheap energy into AI into a manufacturing renaissance could be that way.
Now, do you see, I guess, if we're unsuccessful, say, you know, with this drill baby drill aspect and trying to get into, you know, tap into more of the natural resources of the U.S., is this debt spiral basically to the point where it's almost to the point of no return and this is almost a last-ditch effort?
Yeah, I mean, we're running an uncontrolled experiment that is unique in history, which is the possessor of the global reserve currency is hyperinflating. If you define hyperinflating as, you know, increasing the money supply at an exponential rate, as opposed to just measuring inflation, we've never done this before, right? We're adding $1 trillion in debt every 85 days. There's no end in sight. Now, look, if all this happens and, you know, the Doge team of Elon and Vivek have their way and they cut $1 trillion out of expenditures. Unclear whether we would avoid a recession in that scenario, but at some point you got to take the medicine. You know, there's a path out of here where we significantly cut expenses, cut the waste. There is a ton of waste in Washington. Just look at the Pentagon, you know, $950 billion a year budget and failed 7 audits. We've lined with corruption, you know, unspeakable corruption in the military-industrial complex. Whether Trump can actually tackle that remains to be seen. So, yeah, there's, you know, absent significant change, we seem to be on an irreversible path. And like we said earlier, whether they just drop all this on Trump and take the medicine now and have the added benefit of basically crippling his presidency, you know, we'll see.
Quick break here from this great interview I have with Doomberg. Just to remind you guys to subscribe to the show, rate it 5 stars wherever you get podcasts. If you're listening to this on Fountain, if you can send some sats, boost it, anything that would help support the show would be greatly appreciated. But the subscription, the 5 stars reviews go a very, very long way. So I greatly appreciate that. And if you can do that for me and help spread the word of the Green Candle podcast, I can keep bringing banging guests for you guys and keep everything moving forward. So please do that for your boy and help me out. All right. Enough for me. Let's get back to the show with Doomberg. Whoosh. Well, you know, I guess it's going to be interesting to see the way that these next, you know, 4 years essentially plays out then, with, you know, with everything like that you're lining up here. But, you know, I want to get into Milei. You recently had an article called Cash Cow about Argentina, almost kind of similarly doing what Trump is lining out. And it seems like Milei and Trump are almost one in the same, I would kind of say, you know, they have little similarities. Maybe Milei's a little bit more of a firecracker, but why don't you break down, you know, how you've seen Argentina just kind of, you know, go from where they've started, where, you know, essentially their currency is hyperinflating away. Now they're on a dollar standard, and it seems like things are moving in a positive direction. Do you see it that way as well? And why do you think that, you know, has taken a turn for whichever way you believe it's going?
Yeah, we watched with interest as Milei visited Mar-a-Lago recently and got a standing ovation from the room and seemed to be quite festive. You know, he and Trump are brothers from a different mother, I guess is the phrase that you would use. They have certain differences in their personalities, but very similarly minded. We wrote Cash Cow to highlight that there's an amazing shale resource in Argentina that in another sort of set of circumstances would be a really compelling hydrocarbon resource base that the world would happily exploit. The Vaca Muerta shale is, according to at least one expert that we sort of discovered while researching the piece, as a resource base could easily handle 5 to 6 million barrels a day of oil production. Not that that's where they'll eventually get to, but just to give you a sense of the quality of the deposit, the challenges to the full exploitation of that resource, of course, are the currency issues that you talked about, government stability issues. In order to sort of exploit a shale of that size, like we see in the US, you need a critical mass of services and rigs and so on. And it's kind of like binary. If there's enough people there, then the party starts. And if there isn't, it kind of dissipates. But the trend is in the right direction. Oil production is growing. Gas production is growing. We'll probably exceed 1 to 2 million barrels a day over the next 5-6 years if everything goes to plan. So at the same time, you know, Western super majors who have been burned there before seem to be looking to maybe hit the bid and take the exit. But you have a whole slew of things going on in the sort of Western hemisphere, especially south of the equator, where if the U.S. just focused in its own backyard, we really have everything we need over here and don't even need to bother with the Middle East or even Asia. We have what's going on in Guyana. We have the largest natural resource, largest hydrocarbon resource in the world in Venezuela that is currently wildly underutilized. And then we have what's going on in Argentina. Brazil is an oil and gas superpower. So we have everything we need right here. We have an enormous amount of resources. And if Trump and Milei get their way, I think, you know, that's all sort of back to the opening question of this podcast, not very good for OPEC.
Well, so then do you think that the U.S. should start, I guess, aligning up with Southern and Latin America where, you know, essentially just keep it in our backyard opposed to going and working with Europe? And then if that's the case, then wouldn't that cause some more tension, I guess, from the U.S. essentially pulling away from Europe?
Yeah, again, thermodynamically, that would be a very fine outcome. I mean, the Monroe Doctrine goes back, you know, however many decades, centuries, for a reason. And, you know, there was a time where, well, let's take a step back. Much of modern U.S. foreign policy was developed and taught to our diplomatic corps at a time when Washington believed that the U.S. had seen peak oil production in the country. And Hubbard's peak was real, and he called his shot. And, you know, early 1970s, the U.S. rolled over. And of course, we had the OPEC crisis and the oil scares and the development of the petrodollar system and the deal with the Saudis, however real you might think that is. Because of our shortage of oil, we had to go around the world looking for it and fighting for it. It is our view that the advent of the shale revolution has not penetrated a reformulation of our foreign policy. We have more than enough here. We're actually net exporters of energy now. We have We produce 20% of the world's oil, 25% of the world's natural gas, all this with a hand and a half tied behind our back. Like, California has as much oil and gas as Texas does. It just chooses for political reasons not to develop them. We have Canada to the north, similarly endowed with huge oil and gas resources. Both countries have the most fertile farmland in the world. You know, the whole Peter Zeihan, pro-America stuff, which is true. And so, like, what are we doing going around the world, policing the waters with blue Navy oceans, ocean-bound ships and stuff? It doesn't make any sense objectively anymore. It used to make sense when we were short oil and we had to protect our access to it around the world. But now we're swimming in the stuff, and yet we've not changed our sort of worldview. And I think Trump understands that. And to the extent that he gets to office and is able to affect that change, it could be a really meaningful 4 years. I'll just say one more thing on the subject. You mentioned it's going to be interesting to watch over the 4 years. I think we'll know in 4 months how things are going to go. Like, it's going to be very obvious early whether he is going to be effective or not. And if he's not effective in the first 4 months, I think that'll be pretty much the end of it.
So you're saying maybe after the first quarter of next year, we'll be able to essentially see how this next, the next 3 and 3/4 of a year is going to essentially go. Is that correct?
Yeah, he's either going to get, tripped up out of the starting gate, or he's going to assert dominance over DC and have his way. It's, by the way, we have no strong prediction on the matter, but we do know that those would produce two wildly different results.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess, how important do you think, or do you take any, account that, obviously you mentioned DOGE, the Department of Government and Efficiency, with Vivek and Elon, but getting more of these business leaders into, the political sphere and helping shape some of these political policies, do you think that's going to be beneficial in the long run? Just because it's, people interacting with business, so they kind of know how that area works, or can this prove to be somewhat detrimental, as it's like people with no governmental experience kind of coming in and doing it?
I mean, we just recently wrote a piece called In Praise of Chris Wright, which should give you some indication of what we think of some of Trump's nominees. Look, I mean, take a guy like Chris Wright, who we've gotten to know sort of at the periphery. I wouldn't call him a friend. But we were on a podcast together, and we read his views, and he's largely indistinguishable from Doomberg in his energy outlook, which we, of course, would view as a good thing. The entire inefficiency in the market that Doomberg sort of occupies is that in the energy debate, for example, industry's voice was sorely lacking. The prior commenters and policy formulators either came from universities or only ever worked in government. And most people who know how energy really works are in industry. And most of them are hidden behind public affairs and investor relations teams because they don't want to say the wrong thing or get canceled or, run afoul of government regulators. And Trump's victory changes that in a significant way. And Chris Wright, who is a super talented, brilliant guy, enormously successful, a pioneer in natural gas fracking, created billions of dollars of value for his shareholders, has no real need to jump into the public eye. Kudos to him for being willing to do it. But if he becomes Secretary of Energy, for example, we think that he could have a transformational impact on the U.S. that would last decades. And let's hope that he gets the opportunity.
And this impact that would last decades, I'm assuming you believe it's pretty positive by the way you framed that. And how big of a turnaround would this be for, I guess, the U.S. and as far as like the energy markets go? Because, we've talked previously when you've come on about the green energy policies, and it seems like the U.S. for some reason decided to hinder themselves. Now, the pendulum sort of swinging the opposite direction where, whether it's the climate change or whatever, that we believe that we should be more energy independent from other countries and we're going to start moving in that direction?
I think Trump has kneecapped the climate change movement. And I think COP29 is going to be a giant flop. It is already. I think this is a classic sort of Ben Hunt narrative shift where I mean, dirty little secret is I don't know anybody in the industry who actually thinks climate change is a real problem. They all say it and they all pretend like it is because they kind of have to because everyone else is doing it. But if Trump liberates some people in the industry from having to say those things, we suspect almost all of them will feel liberated from having to say such things. And we'll see a collapse in the movement. It's sort of a giant confidence game anyway, and confidence games always end this way. So I think there's no question that, and by the way, the US, because of a couple of quirks of the way energy is regulated and landowner rights, was not nearly as far down this road as Europe. The real loser in all this is Europe, of course, who has gone much further down the deindustrialization green energy pathway. The US under Biden grew oil and gas production relentlessly, mostly because states like Texas and Louisiana can manage their own affairs. And as long as things don't cross state lines, you can permit rather easily. With Trump coming in, forming this National Energy Council, by the way, which is another development whose whole objective is to get the federal government out of the business of regulating energy. I don't know how that isn't bullish for production, bearish for prices, and bearish for energy equities in the long run. But beyond oil and gas, there's going to be a huge push for nuclear. Trump is keenly interested in it. This coincides with the power needs of the Microsofts and the Googles of the world, and we could see a wave of SMRs built to dedicated to these data centers. I think if we take the opportunity to completely transform the way we view and regulate energy development, and such transformations persist for 3 or 4 years while Trump is president, it's going to be very difficult to overturn those in the future. And so the era of carbon being the primary driver of U.S. energy policy is over, in our view. And I think people are slow to internalize that and what it means, but that's our view.
Now, you mentioned nuclear. Is U.S. primed to be one of the global leaders in nuclear energy and start moving towards that in your view?
Well, we already are. For one, we're the world's leading producer of nuclear energy. We have 93 operating reactors in the country today. China will soon pass us because China is doing everything at warp speed, which they always do. We solved energy in the 50s. I mean, nuclear exists. We know how to do it. It's totally safe. The risks associated with it have been blown wildly out of proportion. All it really takes is politics to get out of the way for this to really transform our society. Happens to be carbon free, although I don't think that's the primary reason you should do it. You should do it because it's the most energy dense, safest form of energy known to humankind. And you know, if fission were invented today, it would be hailed as a civilization-saving innovation. And yet we've cracked it. Eisenhower had it right in the 50s. And if France could build out an entire nuclear fleet and Ontario can build out an entire nuclear fleet 50 years ago, surely we're capable of doing it today with all the advances in technology and safety and know-how. And so that's always been the answer. We've long argued there is no path to decarbonization that doesn't go through nuclear. We've used an environmentalist stance on nuclear as sort of a litmus test for how serious they are, because you can't be genuinely concerned about carbon and also be anti-nuclear. And so there's no real headwinds anymore. And I think the need of the technology companies, who are very powerful in Washington, by the way, and usually get their way, their need for extremely reliable baseload electricity, with nuclear sitting right there as the answer. And by the way, Chris Wright, who is the nominee for Secretary of Energy, sits on the board of Oklo, which is this, Wall Street darling SMR company. And so it's not like he doesn't know that the future is nuclear as well. And so this is why when we saw Chris Wright's nomination come through the Bloomberg machine here, we were so excited to see it.
Yeah. I think the development of that, but I guess in a sense, if we are the global superpower and, leader in nuclear, why aren't we leaning into that more? Has it just been, I don't know, why has that, why is Trump essentially like the first one to kind of come out and start to say all that?
Yeah, there's a powerful force of aging Malthusians who are opposed to the development of bountiful energy for the masses. They think there are too many people on the planet. They'd like for there to be less people on the planet. They don't say it in that way, but that's their core belief. These people came up at a time when you know, population explosion and all of this stuff was all the rage in the 60s and the 70s. Frankly, it comes from a pretty ugly history of eugenics if you go deep enough. There's literally books written in the 60s called Too Many Asians, for example, that was reviewed favorably in the New York Times. It's amazing that you couldn't say or write those things today, of course, but they did. And it's important to go back and read that history so that you can get a true mindset of what the leaders and the founders of the Sierra Clubs and the Greenpeaces of the world actually think. That's what they actually think. They deny it today, or they try to cover up that ugly history, and they'll claim that, you know, no serious environmentalist today holds those views. But if you scratch beneath the surface, that's actually what they think. There's too many people. The sort of the genesis of the view is as follows. If we give people endless supplies of cheap energy, they'll also need endless supplies of all the other materials that the Earth has to supply, and we'll run out of some of the most important ones, and we won't be able to maintain the population, 7-8 billion people living at standards of living that you and I are blessed enough to enjoy today. We happen to think that is a deeply unethical view to hold, and it's also a giant short bet against human ingenuity, but that's the basis of it. The reason why nuclear has been slowed in the U.S. is because cheap, plentiful electricity energy is the worst nightmare of a bunch of Malthusians who think there's too many people on the planet.
So it's more of a depopulation kind of movement where, you know, there's too many people, and so we don't need more energy. Is that sort of right in short?
Yeah, like if there's not enough energy for the rest of the world to develop, more of the world's resources will be preserved for us, quote unquote, speaking from their perspective. That's the view. I mean, this is not a controversial statement, by the way. Like, you just Google Thomas Malthus, and you could read the whole history. You could read the founding of the Sierra Club and limits to growth crowd, you know, that old, and by the way, they're literally dying out and becoming a smaller and smaller minority. And I think to Biden's credit, by the way, to correct something that you said, he has been pushing for nuclear. Jennifer Granholm has been pushing for nuclear. They led and cut a deal at COP28 last year to triple world nuclear installations by 2050. This is a bipartisan consensus now, but the most vocal opponents just happen to be to the left of Biden's coalition, whereas Trump is unburdened by such people.
Now, with that, how did they not understand that, you know, previous, in history, whenever a society has been able to accumulate more energy or harness more energy, use that in order for their advantage, that societies have essentially advanced. I mean, it's like there's multiple historical examples of that. So I guess, why are they able to flip the narrative? Is it just against the core physics principles that energy can neither be created nor destroyed? Or, is there, I guess, so much of this narrative around, like, quote unquote, wasting energy?
Yeah, so it's not so much about wasting energy. It's taxing the other resources of the Earth beyond what's possible. Like, the Earth is not a closed system. Of course, we're bombarded with energy every day from the sun. But to go a little deeper on it, they come from a worldview where humans are distinct from nature and nature needs to be protected from humans, as opposed to the school of thought that human flourishing should come first, and that we are more than capable of flourishing on the planet while preserving as much of nature as we need to for human flourishing. So it's literally just the foundational axiom from which you view the world. Like, nature needs to be preserved, and humans are sort of a cancer inside of nature, not part of nature. We are not in that camp, of course. We think the 7 billion people in the global south have just as much right as you and I have to a better way of living. They live on a fraction of the energy budgets that you and I get to waste, and they will do whatever it takes to pull themselves up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and they can eventually get to the point where they're worried about carbon emissions. They're not today. And so that's just sort of the fundamental differences in worldview. And then if you read the environmental left, which we do, because we try to read all sides of all you know, arguments and debates. You see that come through in the writing and the thinking, the degrowth movement. Why can't we make do with less? You know, greedy consumerism of the West is ruining the planet, and so on and so on. And those are just the two different starting points, which is why there's not much overlap in the Venn diagram between people who hold those two views.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, there's definitely a dramatic shift. But, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, President Trump's, you know, presidency or the potential policies that he would implement. You know, the timeline, we'll be able to see if he's able to, you know, I guess, implement that within the first quarter or so of his presidency. Now, you've said that you think it's, you know, bullish for oil production and bearish for oil price, which overall would seem good for the economy. Now, what is your view on his other economic policies and how he would be able to, I guess, implement them? Do you see potentially a positive change? You know, what do you think of the potential change in the interest rate environment as well, where it seems like Trump will be pushing for next to zero interest rates and kind of going at Jerome Powell in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at it. We think on balance, Trump is pretty inflationary. He likes numbers to go up, stock market to go up. He'll lean on the Fed to cut short-term interest rates, keep a close eye on the long bond. I think we're seeing interest rates creep up and the market sort of flushing that out. But I think he views the next 4 years as an opportunity to recreate the 80s. I'm sure he would probably view himself as in the mold of Ronald Reagan. And he wants an industrial revolution in the U.S. He wants to bring manufacturing home. He wants to erect tariffs against China for that purpose. And so I think on balance, this is going to be an inflationary pulse that we're about to live through. You know, just on immigration, like if you deport as many people as he claims to be wanting to deport, that's going to create labor shortages in our view, which is going to create you know, wage pressures and so on. Sort of in our view, the flows, there's certainly deflationary aspects of his policies as well, but the flows are on balance are going to be net inflationary. And I think the early 80s would be a useful model to ponder how the next few years will look.
Now, with the inflationary aspect, then, you know, even though we have the energy markets, would that, I guess, like further in your view, the potential of hyperinflation here?
Yeah, so a burst in energy production is deflationary. That's why I said, you know, the flows and how they cancel each other out. I mean, a huge amount of cheap energy is deflationary, but it's also very bullish for the economy and could cause the economy to overheat. So predicting inflation, of course, is notoriously hard. Because, again, this is sort of a classic nonlinear system with sensitive dependence on initial conditions. But if you pinned us to the wall and said I or D, we would vote I.
Okay. Now that is, yeah, it's kind of interesting because it almost seems like to me we would be then in an asset bubble where, you know, maybe the underlying economy would be doing okay, maybe not great. And then, you know, we'd see assets just absolutely rip and roar, which would cause, you know, the growth or the growth of the wealth gap and some other potential issues. And, you know, simply that would be a main cause of that would be the massive amounts of inflation that we could potentially see. Is that, I guess, a similar prediction that you would make?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bitcoin and its recent price activity supports that. But the recent price activity in gold does not. So we're kind of seeing mixed signals. Now, gold is suddenly responding to the strong dollar again, even though it ignored strong dollar for much of the run-up prior to the election. And Bitcoin has its own reasons for that particular number going up, of course. So mixed signals. But I think, yeah, if we're right, and if Trump is successful, yeah, we will, in our view, see another asset bubble almost certainly.
What are some of the reasons you feel that, you know, Bitcoin's prices has seen the recent run up?
You know, I think the Wall Street takeover of the Bitcoin franchise, so to speak, is playing a big role in it. I would direct your viewers to a wonderful piece written by the Epsilon Theory blog a couple of years ago called In Praise of Bitcoin with an exclamation point at the end of Bitcoin. And that exclamation point is a really important marker. The approval of the ETFs, I see now this morning that I think options on those ETFs are going to be tradable here soon, if not already. I think Michael Saylor is kind of running a flywheel where MicroStrategy is worth multiple times the total value of the Bitcoins he has in his possession, which makes it very sensible for him to sell more stock to buy more Bitcoin until that gap closes. And the market doesn't seem to want that gap to close, which means he could end up buying an awful lot of Bitcoin. And that could effectively corner the market for a scarce asset. And so all of the things that the number go up crowd have been hoping and for and predicting seems to be at least partially coming to pass, and good for them. Congratulations to all those who are long Bitcoin. I'm certainly happy for you. And so we'll see. Fascinating to watch for sure. I quite enjoy it. It's history to observe. You know, I've been in and around Bitcoin for many, many years. We once made an investment in a early Bitcoin company that was a fascinating story back before, you know, Bitcoin was even on anybody's radar. I think the first quote I saw of Bitcoin was around $200. That's what I remember. And then, of course, it had the famous run-up and so on the first time around when it really blew up. So it's interesting to watch. I genuinely admires the, perhaps the wrong word, but I watch with a knowing smirk what Michael Saylor is up to, and I tip my hat to the man, because he has called his shots. And I would say we owe a bit of debt of gratitude to Michael Saylor. The way in which we have grown our newsletter is to try and be the best, most prolific podcast guest possible. And that is actually a tactic that we stole from him. The man was everywhere as he built up the strategy. And in fact, Trump borrowed that strategy in this campaign, proving that alternative media is really the future. And so Doomberg would not be as successful as it currently is were it not for Michael Saylor. And so, you know, kudos to him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he definitely, you know, put his balls on the table here too with his, his Bitcoin strategy too, to say the very least. But it seems like others are, you know, following suit, whether it's, you know, Trump doing the same kind of, spoke at the Bitcoin conference recently. Actually just saw somebody running for president, I believe, in Poland, and, you know, offering a strategic Bitcoin reserve. So it seems like this game theory is somewhat playing out. So it'll be, sure. Interesting to see kind of how this furthers along. But, you know, Doomberg, go ahead.
I was just saying, success has many fathers, or has many parents, I suppose. And Trump, I think, was shrewd to attend the Bitcoin conference. You know, this election was always going to come down to several tens of thousands of votes in swing states. And I think taking the Bitcoin issue as his own was a shrewd move. The Bitcoin movement is nothing if not vocal and passionate. And so I think he played those cards quite well, and probably meant it. So, you know, good for him. But yeah, like, again, it is fascinating to see, and success has many parents. So.
Yeah, 100%. And you've been very generous with your time and being a recurring guest on the podcast. But for those who maybe missed previous episodes with you, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you, and subscribe to your Substack.
Yeah, we're at Doomberg.com. We ejected a squatter from that domain name, and so now we're in possession of it. And you'll find all of our articles there. We have we try to publish about 8 articles a month. And then our pro tier, which is all those articles plus an additional webinar a month directly from the Doomberg team. All of our podcast appearances are there as well. You find everything Doomberg at Doomberg.com. And look, it was great. I'm looking forward to the next appearance. Maybe we'll come back 4 months into Trump's administration and we could give him a scorecard.
Yeah, 100%. We'll have to get that on the calendar. So Doomberg, thanks so much. And I'll put all that in the show notes. So everybody be sure to check it out. And yeah, everybody follow along the internet's favorite green chicken.